You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about virtual learning and online coursework amid the pandemic. I can officially say that 2 months in, the novelty of distance learning has worn off with my school-age kids. They get excited for the social stimulation of Zoom meetings and seeing their teachers and fellow students. But getting this actual schoolwork done is a real struggle now, and the school year is rapidly coming to an end. What have you noticed about moving to an all-online curriculum? Parents, have you had to work hard to keep your young students focused on schoolwork? College students, how did your professors manage to deliver content for your classes that were abruptly moved online this spring? Let's talk about it. 800-642-1234. Angie Stomba is director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. Angie, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Welcome. I'm happy to be here.
And we also have Maria Perez-Torrell, who is director of online pedagogy and e-learning production at Marquette University. Maria, welcome to you.
Hi, good morning. Thank you for having me.
Well, Maria, help us understand how e-learning got its start and where the history comes from for this learning platform, how it's evolved over the years.
Yeah, sure. So distance learning has been around for decades. It started basically with correspondence courses where, you know, someone would enroll in a course, they would get a package in the mail, get some materials, maybe take exams, send them back, and get evaluated for those. It has over the years become more sophisticated as technology has evolved and become available, as well as the learning and teaching research has evolved. Now, like, what are the best practices for setting up a course online so that students can be successful? So as all those have been evolving, currently, courses are usually hosted in a platform and learning management system such as D2L, Canvas, Moodle, and everything is organized in there for the students. There's other types of courses like MOOCs, massive open online courses that are free and available for people to take on specific skills, and just more, they have a broader reach than courses that are matriculated within a university, for example, for people that are seeking a degree.
Yeah, Moodle and MOOCs are words I know I've heard before, but, mm-hmm. you know, a lot of these platforms, it's just, you know, there are so many different ones out there. It's hard to really right. know what it all means. It's like an alphabet soup.
Yeah. Yeah, right. Well, usually that's what the university takes care of, or the institution or the schools. They decide based on the type of courses that they offer, what is a platform that they use. So the students really don't go about designing that platform.
It's they don't know that provided. Back end. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Angie, from your perspective, for a first-time student who is new to virtual learning, how does one dip their toe into this, get structured, and be able to get off to a good start?
Yeah, it is, could be very overwhelming with many different platforms and different schools using different things. Mm-hmm. Usually a school will try to pick one that they try to stay in and use, and it's really important for the student to take a little bit of time to understand how the course works. So many of these platforms have some way just to, like, here's a little tutorial to get you started, or your instructor will say, you know, here are the important parts that you need to work through. For a student, I would definitely say spend time figuring out what this looks like and where I can click around and go and just kind of explore it a little bit. Also know where your resources are. Is there a phone number you can call? Is there someone you email? Are there videos you can watch to kind of to stay on track? Because that will make it easier. The more comfortable you come exploring the area, the more comfortable and quicker you can do things. But really, it's about setting up time and structure. It's really easy in online to be like, yeah, I'll do that later, or to underestimate how much time you need to spend. But think about it as if you're going to a normal class, going out into the community where you normally go to class, like I have it from 9 to 10, set that up in your schedule and spend that time on the classes, because otherwise time is really easy to get away from you.
I'm hearing time management is key here. Angie Stamba is with us, Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. Maria Perez-Torrell, Director of Online Pedagogy in E-Learning Production at Marquette here as well. And are you enrolled in an online program? Do you think online classes would be easier or harder than in-person classes? What about hybrid courses? Have you tried those? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Maria, explain the difference between synchronous and asynchronous and what hybrid looks like.
Yeah, of course. So it's all about the modality in which the course is being delivered. So asynchronous basically just means that you don't have to be online at a specific time, where synchronous means exactly the opposite. You are required to be online at a specific time, and it's a real-time live interaction with your peers or with the instructor. The asynchronous has the benefit that it's more flexible. So if you have other responsibilities like family or work, things like that, it allows to work on its sort of self-paced, but it's guided within deadlines for a time frame for the activities or learning assessments that you're completing.
So I think during the pandemic, we've seen a bit of both, where mm-hmm. we've seen the Zoom meetings at a particular time on particular days, and then all of this other content that you can do outside that.
Yeah. So something that's important to notice is that during the pandemic, really what has happened is more remote teaching, not the fully online learning and teaching that typically, of course, it was a crisis mode. No, we had to move courses online, and the infrastructure for the institutions and the school varied depending on how much online they have typically offered. So remote, a lot of times in this case, meant just how can I continue doing exactly what I was doing in my face-to-face, for example, lecturing, but at a distance. And that's where a lot of what we're hearing about, that Zoom fatigue, no, because a lot of it was just, okay, so now connect to Zoom for a synchronous session, and I'm going to do my lecture.
Zoom right? fatigue, that's a thing. I'm going to pick that up, Maria. I am. Angie, what have you seen out of the pandemic with this whole remote teaching and certainly professors having to move to online courses, pivoting immediately?
Yeah, the professors had to learn a lot of skills in a very short amount of time. And the difficulty with this happening halfway through the semester was that things that were already created and going on in the classroom were just stopped and had to be moved online. For example, there were many people who were doing group presentations and things with their classes that half the class had already presented. Now, how do I get the other half to present online as a group? And so many of the initial planning phases was about how do I get some of the things that have already started moved on. Now, if I was doing this completely online, would I have even had that type of project? Not necessarily. We also had the struggle of things that really are hands-on, like lab classes, performance art classes. How do you move art classes online when students were abruptly told go home and may not even have the supplies? So professors had to get very creative and use lots of virtual resources that may have been out there, or, for example, in labs, create the lab, do the lab, video it for the students so they could see what it would be, and then perhaps give them the information to work through the problems and understand it how it would happen. So professors had to think quickly, make it happen, and many of them still learn how to use the technology at the same time.
We're talking about how to deliver online courses amid the pandemic. UW-Eau Claire's Angie Stamba there, Maria Perez-Torrell from Marquette, and you at 800-642-1234. How are you adjusting to online courses? We'll be back in just a minute. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the complexities of online learning. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Experts warn of the COVID slide, that learning loss over the summer. Educators, they've historically transitioned tens of millions of kids from brick and mortar education to a digital one. We're taking stock of what we know about online education today during the pandemic. What areas need more work? How is online learning going for you and your family? Are you a non-traditional student who needs online classes to make school possible with your family and work? What have you discovered about virtual learning during the pandemic? Let's explore this. 800-642-1234. We have two online learning experts. We have Maria Perez-Torrell from Marquette University and Angie Stamba from UW-Eau Claire, and they stay with us. Angie, I have noticed, too, that there have been some professors who have been really nervous about transitioning their courses to an online platform, especially when they may be more comfortable in front of a class and in person. And I was reading about this one professor at the UW who went through a painstaking process of making videos, as you mentioned, experiments, making videos of all of her class presentations, and then just delivering them online because she was so nervous about the technology. What can you say about that type of transition and the stress it puts on faculty?
Yeah, it's just how it puts stress on students. It does for faculty as well. Many faculty have spent their careers in front of students, being able to judge the reactions of the students and knowing where more questions and things are coming from the students. And when we move to the technology, it's often very limited. You don't get that feedback, and you don't know exactly how to structure or break it down in ways that make sense. And so by recording, as some have done, and putting the lecture up there, they feel they're still capturing their passion and in front of the camera for them. But it does still create that inability to get that feedback from the students. So we've tried to work with faculty to set up ways, how do you communicate, how do you get feedback from students, how do you keep students engaged in it as well. But when you are suddenly forced into this, it's hard to do that very quickly. It takes time to build all those things. So in this pandemic, many have gone to that route in order to get the materials out and then hope to have conversations with the students through discussion boards or email or whatever needs to happen.
And when you say feedback, Maria, I'm thinking you need feedback from the class because they have questions as you go through the material. But then you also need feedback to find out how this is working in the online realm. And you know, the faculty need to absorb that and figure out how to make tweaks.
Yes, no, definitely. And something that we've done, for example, at Marquette was precisely because of that. We built in surveys for the courses so that students could provide feedback for our faculty as we were transitioning. We also sent out a survey for faculty and students campus-wide to get a sense of what worked, what didn't, and how can we continue improving, because we know that, unfortunately, this situation is not something that is over. We're looking now at summer being all online, and decisions are being made about the fall.
How does a student measure if an online course is meeting expectations, meeting its goals? How do you measure that?
So engagement is a big factor. Also, what are the goals? You know, what are those learning outcomes? So something that we emphasize a lot when we are working with faculty is everything that you're doing in your course needs to go back to those learning outcomes. What do students need to be able to do by the end of the course? And in that rapid shift to remote teaching, we guide it, okay, so what is absolutely essential in your course? What are the priorities to ensure that your students are achieving that? No, and that building self-assessments and looking at the students, okay, so can you do this? And what is the evidence? How did you do it? To really gauge if they were successful in that regard. But that said, there's the other factor of, did they enjoy it? No, and sometimes two get meshed, right? The student might think, oh, well, I really didn't like this experience. But those feelings are wrapped with a lot of other things that are going on that don't necessarily mean they weren't successful in achieving those learning outcomes, but rather, you know, it was chaotic. I didn't choose this, right? That's something that was very present for a lot of people, not faculty, but students too. That's not how they had chosen to receive their, you know, and engage in their education. And suddenly that was the only choice.
We're talking with Maria Perez-Toro, who is Director of Online Pedagogy and E-Learning Production at Marquette University. Angie Stamba is Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. Your insights at how you've learned during the pandemic and online instruction. What are some things that your teachers have done that have helped you engage and have helped you learn during this time of virtual learning? Be part of this conversation, 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Angie, what are some classes that really translate to an online environment? Are there popular ones that can be taught online very well?
Almost any class can be translated. It's just thinking about what tools to use. The difficult ones are some of those hands-on kind of things, but things that use a lot of media or opportunities to engage with different types of like videos and interactions are things that are often popular with the students. An example is we have an English professor who teaches actual films and looking at different genres of films, and his class is very popular. He has the films in there. He also creates his own little characters in it and so ties it in. So some of those really interactive. Other ones that are pretty successful is if you can build in engagement amongst the students and not just with the instructor. So whatever the topic may be, how do you get the students to engage and have meaningful conversations? Sometimes in those discussion forums, either small breakout groups or actual writing discussions, those things can get a lot deeper than they may be in the classroom because everyone has a chance to have a voice. So every topic can be done. It's just that meaningful creation at the beginning and planning to set up those opportunities.
Interesting you say that you know, that online learning may go deeper in those areas where everyone can participate and maybe feels more open to doing so in that environment.
We are seeing, we've had several professors already report that they're actually getting more engaging conversations than they've had in the classroom. People feel they can have a voice in a safe place. They have often opportunities to take the time to formulate their thoughts, to put that down, instead of sometimes in the classroom when you have to quickly come up with it because of the pace of the class. This gives a time for reflection for our students and really pull in what they think about something or pull in extra materials.
Maria, are you seeing any indication of that pacing and reflection is bringing together maybe better, more thorough conversations?
Yes, definitely. And that's something earlier you had asked about, for example, if asynchronous modality, that's something too that for students when they're choosing if they online is the right learning space for them, it does impact that time for reflection and time to think through, especially if you're someone that you're not a native English speaker, if you have learning disabilities, that time on task that you have, as Angie mentioned, not being in a way having to react right away, but rather really processing the information that is in front of you, writing your posts and reviewing it prior to actually publishing it. Things like that definitely do lead to deeper reflection and processing of the information.
Well, Angie, you know, you touched on this a little bit before, but making sure that you schedule your time correctly. Time management, a big one here with these asynchronous courses. What advice can you give?
I think it's important to actually set up a schedule. First, it's easy to get lost. Like, I always have time, so schedule. Trying to find a place is another thing that's being difficult for students is finding a quiet place or somewhere where they can often work. Many of our students, both K through 12 and through college, now they're in the home environment, and there's lots of things competing, as well as maybe parents or siblings or roommates, all in that same space trying to complete work and things. So finding your own space, your own time, and then really sitting down, because there's multiple courses, and figuring out a calendar. When are things due? What are the expectations? How much time do I need to invest? It's just like things they would do in a face-to-face environment. The only advantage we have in a face-to-face environment is that you already have that schedule made for you, because you have classes that you're attending at certain times. When the world's wide open, you need to figure out what those times are. Now, it doesn't have to be a traditional daytime. If you work better in the evening, nights, that's fine. But what is that schedule that you're going to commit yourself to?
Because there can be so many distractions, especially at home.
Exactly. At home, there's things like your computer there, Netflix there. Oh, I'm working in my bedroom. Might as well take a nap. You know, all those things are real when you're at home, but that you don't have when you're out in the face-to-face environment.
We have Angie Stamba, who directs the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. Marie Perez-Torrell heads up online pedagogy and e-learning production at Marquette. And you, are you enrolled in an online program? Did you complete an associate's or a bachelor's, a graduate degree that was delivered online? What can you say about advantages and drawbacks of virtual learning? There's room to talk about this. 800-642-1234. We'll have more after a news update. Maybe hear from you on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Just a brief mention that WPR continues to bring you coverage of the latest developments from our reporters around the state. We've centralized our news posts and analysis on the coronavirus pandemic. It's all at WPR.org/COVID. Right now, educators are worried about students falling behind. This period of remote learning, technology divides, lowered expectations, it's all stalled progress for many learners. But students who are still learning English, a group that swelled to 5 million students nationwide, they are losing even more ground, perhaps. Is English your second language? And does that have you concerned about taking online courses? Do you have a student on an IEP, an individualized educational plan, or a student with a learning disability? Are you able to make progress on the plan in a virtual setting? What is the challenge? Be part of this. 800-642-1234. Angie Stamba directs the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. Maria Perez-Torrell is Director of Online Pedagogy and E-Learning Production at Marquette, and they stay with us. Maria, let's look at English learners, millions of them who are now in an online learning environment. What steps should we take to make sure that we don't leave these learners behind?
Yeah, so I myself was a second language online learner in part of my education. And I can tell you from experience, but then also in terms of research base that shows what we can do to help that population, you know, just being very aware of that we have different learners. And that doesn't just apply for someone that English is not their first language. Thinking about when deciding, am I going to have those synchronous sessions, you know, live sessions, that might put my students at a disadvantage, right? So, for example, if I am presenting and the students don't have closed caption, they don't have a transcript, they might miss out words and not be able to follow. So providing materials ahead of time is a way to help students. Providing opportunities for them to send questions ahead of time is another way, so that way you could be addressing that during those sessions. Something to keep in mind is the language proficiency. Their ability with the language is going to be very varied, you know, and that will influence how well they can engage. So it's also going back to that awareness, thinking of, okay, how am I communicating with the students? So if I'm posting an announcement in the learning management system with an update or asking them to do something, and am I using colloquialisms? Am I using idioms that someone that is not a native speaker might struggle with, not really understand what the message is? So just being aware of little things like that go a long way. also providing options. So, and this is something that helps learners across, regardless of their abilities, their language, but really how are you providing options in how you're presenting the content, and also for them to demonstrate their skills and knowledge, right? Electronic accessibility, so WCAG 2.0 standards, 508 regulations are, you know, they're standards that are there for a reason, no, to protect those students that, for example, you mentioned learning disabilities. So what happens if you have a student that needs to use a screen reader to access that information? How are you ensuring that that's set up? So reaching out, looking at your institution, at your school, what are the resources that are already in place for those type of accommodations, and working very closely with those to ensure that you're doing everything that you can to provide accessible materials for your students.
Angie, let's look at that a little more closely for students on an IEP, an individualized educational plan, or a student who does need a screen reader or has a disability. How can you ensure that they make progress in a virtual setting that was just thrust upon them in the pandemic?
The important part with that is the communication with the students as an instructor. So we're often, it's up to the student to often make instructors aware of it. In the K-12 setting, they most likely the teachers know. In the college setting, faculty members don't always know unless the student has worked with the Office of Students with Disabilities. And in that case, then, once we are aware of the student, it really involves a conversation with the instructor and that student, and try to really focus on the progress and what things are difficult. Unfortunately, for our students, a lot of times they are the advocates for what they need and working with that Office of Students with Disabilities, because many instructors may not have any formal preparation on how to work with students who have specific plans, but we do have the resources of offices on campus that will help us as instructors. So the student needs to advocate for their needs, and instructors are really open to trying to make that happen, and often being like, well, what do you need? How can I be helpful? Do we need to have some office hours where I can assist, and make sure that the progress is occurring? The hardest thing for an instructor is when we don't know that, or there's silence, or a student is feeling so overwhelmed but never reaches out. We don't often know how we can help them. So as a student, I would say advocate for yourself. Reach out to your instructor. Reach out to that resource on campus.
It sounds like, too, the college setting is quite different than the K-12 setting, where there are plans in place for that student at each stage of learning.
The students meet on college. They'll meet with the Students with Disabilities office, and a plan is created.
Okay.
But it is still up to the student to get that plan to the instructor. It's not formally given to the instructor by that office. So in the K-12, you know, those things are shared, the plan's there, we have the expectations, and the instructor knows right away. What happens in the college setting is giving the students some autonomy to decide how much they would like to disclose or advocate for. So it does change a little bit in that college setting.
Talking with Angie Stambaugh, Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire, Maria Perez-Torrell here as well, Director of Online Pedagogy and E-Learning Production at Marquette University in Milwaukee. Still time for you. What do you think will be the future of online learning now that you have done it during the pandemic? Will you want to continue this type of education platform? Join in at 800-642-1234. Things you've learned, things you like, things you've disliked. What are the things that your educator, what has made all the difference? Call in. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. So, Maria, early last week, there was a survey that found that nearly a third of current and prospective college students said they preferred not to attend college in the fall if classes remain online only. What would you say there? Are you surprised at all by that statistic?
So I would go back to what I mentioned earlier, that what was experienced by many students is not online learning, but rather remote learning. And bring just light of the context of the rapid change of, you know, faculty who had never done that suddenly had to learn how to do it and quickly move and ensuring that instructional continuity. That said, really assessing, you know, that social aspect of what learning, the learning experience is for students, especially students that are just graduating from high school and we're looking forward to, you know, being at the dorm or, you know, that type, that social aspect is very, very important part of their development and their education, not just the academics. So I guess I'm not surprised. I would say that communication moving forward is very important between the students and their schools that they're looking at and the institutions that they want to attend to really get a sense of what are the plans, you know, and if it's online, what is the institution doing to prepare for fall so that faculty are better equipped and prepared on and it's more of an online learning experience rather than remote, which can be sometimes a little bit more disconnected than the online.
Angie, you know, students have been concerned, college students in particular, that they're getting the value out of their education with that price tag and making this remote learning a value to them. And do you anticipate there will be some reluctance from students to look at that tuition in the same way if they continue to be in a virtual setting for all their coursework?
I think that's a real concern for many students. I mean, the value of college overall is always a concern for students. And when they're looking at what they wanted and expected their college to be, with that face-to-face, social opportunities, organizations, you know, internships, and that really forming life experiences, they may feel that online is not going to meet that need. As far as the learning outcomes and what the expectations are to move them on in their education, that will be there, but it's going to require the students to think a little bit differently about how they approach it. It's also going to be competing with, oh, I could get a job, so I'll work more hours too because now it's online and I have more flexibility. So I think what happens for the value part is also looking at what the student themselves values at that point in their life. And so if they are really missing that interactions with their classmates in the dorms and all that, then they may feel the value's not there. But as far as the value for the learning and the outcomes and getting them the degree to move them on further in life, that value is still there. It's just their perception of what a college education should be.
There's also been talk of streamlining majors in the UW system, avoiding duplication. You know, if that plan goes forward and students look at an online catalog, a broad catalog, what should they be thinking about if they're going to be attending, you know, basically a major at a different campus?
Yeah, I think, you know, that is something in this online environment that people may be more willing to shop around and look for different colleges, not just for what they may have had in that face-to-face environment, but maybe what they have to offer. The important part to look at is really to see, make sure that the institution is accredited in what you want, that whatever courses that you might take in that online environment and shopping around is going to transfer where you ultimately want to end up. Because there's lots of online courses out there, but you may find that they don't transfer to where you want to be.
Angie Stamba, Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire, Maria Perez-Torrell, Director of Online Pedagogy at Marquette, and you, 800-642-1234. Still time to talk about virtual learning. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Education technology firms have stepped forward to help move student learning to the virtual realm. Some companies are making their paid services free through the rest of the school year. Others are lifting limits to services or adding features to what's already free. Education experts call the pandemic a wake-up call for online learning. How has this push to online learning affected your household? Still time, 800-642-1234. We have two online learning experts with us, Angie Stamba from UW-Eau Claire and Maria Perez-Torrell, who is at Marquette. Maria, let's turn to the summer months and looking toward fall. How are your professors going to use summer to prepare for the fall semester? What do you see ahead?
Yeah, so We are still working on summer courses for particularly the second session, and they're all going to be online. However, in terms of preparing for fall, at Marquette, we are planning on having an in-person experience with online components. So a blended experience that for students. With that, obviously, there are contingency plans of what are you going to do to ensure that we have equitable access to learning for all students, because the reality is that things are changing quickly. We can't fully predict, what's going to happen in a few months. As we can see, life can be very different in a matter of days or weeks. But really gauging how can we best offer a full experience to students, not only in that academic side, but in those other interactions, how can we provide support services for those students that are going to have to inevitably take courses online. So, for example, we have international students who cannot return. They can't come to campus. So how are we going to ensure that those students can continue advancing in their education? So that equitable access, in that blended modality where students can switch to the online and go back or be in person, assuming that the circumstances allow for that in person, are what we're working on. And then with that, there's a lot that we're doing. We have a full program across the whole summer for faculty regarding course design for online and blended courses in terms of what are the best practices for facilitation, how are you going to teach, how are you going to make sure that you are present in your courses. There's a lot of research and anecdotal evidence showing that instructor presence in the online environment is key for students not to feel isolated, to be successful, to feel engaged. So what are those strategies? And really just preparing faculty to do better, to really
giving them those tools.
Time.
Yeah, right. That you have some time to really work with them. Angie, what does the future hold for you? How are you preparing faculty for fall?
It's similar to Marquette in that we're offering, it's going to be similar in the sense that we hope to have everyone at campus, but we also need to be aware of safety for our students and social distancing and where exactly we may be in this pandemic at that time. So we're planning face-to-face, but again, with some of that online blended options or ways in order to facilitate. So we are asking faculty now and preparing professional development over the summer that would focus on having your plan ready, making your components, have a plan for some of that blended, have a plan if something happens with the pandemic that you need to completely go online. We want our students there, our faculty want to be there, but we also have to be safe and ensure that everyone is safe, faculty, staff, and students, and that parents feel comfortable having their students on campus. So we are working in the same sense to have time to put courses online and not having to do it very quickly.
Well, thank you both so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
No, thank you.
Maria Perez-Torrell is the Director of Online Pedagogy and E-Learning Production at Marquette University in Milwaukee. We also had Angie Stamba, who is Director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at UW-Eau Claire. And for disclosure, Marquette University is a business sponsor of Wisconsin Public Radio. And now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's a story about contact tracing.
As a public health nurse, Eva Radomski is used to stepping in when a crisis arises. Like many healthcare workers around the world, she's had to switch gears to help people during the pandemic. For Radomski, that means working as a contact tracer, a person who helps figure out how COVID-19 is spreading in Wisconsin. WPR's Jenny Peek talked with Radomski about what it's been like to leave her usual job, which focused on tuberculosis, to help fight COVID-19.
Eva Radomski is a public health nurse for Public Health Madison and Dane County. Since early March, she's been calling people who have tested positive for COVID-19, finding out who they've been in contact with, and informing those people they've been exposed to the virus. It's a tool to connect the dots of how COVID-19 is spreading, hopefully slowing it down along the way.
Contact tracing is a tool that helps slow the spread in a very easy way. It's a way for us to make a phone call to let them know they've been exposed, that they need to isolate, and that stops one more person from spreading the communicable disease, in this case, COVID-19. You interview the person who tested positive for COVID-19. We start by identifying when their symptoms started, and then we go back an additional 2 days. Then from that date, we ask them who they've been around and where they've been. They give us, you know, as much information as they can about the people and the contact information to get a hold of them. And then that's when the contact tracing begins.
Radomski says a lot of people she talks to already know they've been exposed. It's a welcome relief so that she doesn't have to be the bearer of bad news.
There are a few people who we do tell them that they've been exposed, and they are, like any human, frightened or angry, sad, worried. And that's okay, because then we are the resource for them. We go over the recommendations that the CDC has about what they have to do for isolation and what criteria needs to be met for them to discontinue their isolation. We also go over what to do for household members, you know, separating themselves, social distancing in the household.
Even so, she says there's still confusion. People often wonder how long they have to isolate and how to navigate what can feel like constantly changing recommendations.
I think the hardest part is people understanding when they're okay to discontinue isolation. So we really just reference them to the Public Health Madison and Dane County website, and for them to check that frequently, because we do update that on a regular basis, along with, you know, being able to contact any of us public health nurses at any time, and we're happy to help.
Along with an increase in contact tracing, the state is also increasing access to testing, including a site in Dane County.
If you do think you've had an exposure and or are having symptoms, Dane County is now having mass testing available at the Alliant Energy Center, where anyone can go get tested no matter your symptoms. And there's drive up, walk up, bike up. And if you don't have transportation, you can reach out to public health, and we are more than happy to help arrange transportation for you.
While the stress of the moment may make tensions high, Radomski wants people to know that contact tracers, like herself, are there to help clear up some of the uncertainties surrounding COVID-19.
I think it's just important to know that when we're calling you, you know, we're calling with a helpful heart. We're calling you just to let you know and to provide helpful information and education. And we understand frustration and understand any human feelings. And we are more than willing to take suggestions or dive deep to find extra education or information that you need. Please reach out to us with any, you know, questions or concerns that you might have, because we are more than willing to, you know, go that extra mile to make people feel safe at home and in the community.
WPR's Jenny Peek brought us that story on Eva Radomski, a COVID-19 contact tracer in Dane County. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And coming up, we head to Racine County. Drive-through testing opened up in the county after more than 1,000 cases of the coronavirus have been reported and 19 deaths. We talk with the Racine County executive about the approach to containing the spread. Stay with us for that conversation. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.